oral history interview with Akira Ike Iwasaki. The date is May 29th, 1998. The interviewer is Linda Dodds for the Washington County Historical Society, and the interview is being conducted at Mr. Iwasaki's home in Hillsboro. Mr. Iwasaki, I'd like to start today by asking you about your military service in the Army during World War II. Why don't we just start in the beginning and tell me about your participation in the Army.
When the evacuation order prior to that came about, I was asked to conscripted into the service, and I took my basic training. Our experience with other fellow GIs was very cordial. There was no discrimination. I trained mostly with GIs from the Midwest and the Eastern Coast, and many, their first experience to us was quite, without any prejudice. They were very friendly, and so we got along real good.
Do you think they were less prejudiced than GIs on the West Coast might have been?
Yes, I did notice that, because the GIs on from the West Coast, however, they did not outwardly show any discrimination, but they were more used to associating or seeing us. But when I trained in Kentucky, many of the soldiers were kind of curious if I was, you know, Japanese or Chinese, or their first experience with Orientals. Mm-hmm. That was the experience I had.
How big was your unit that you were in there? Was it, did you have many other Japanese in your unit there, or were you just a few?
There were just very few. There was one other young man from Banks of Japanese ancestry that I was training with. So all the other soldiers were, you know, new to me, very strange to me. In fact, I had a very lonely feeling at the time, because I felt I was all by myself.
Were you allowed to communicate with your family?
Yes, only by letters. So I did write occasionally, but I often think back that when I was in the service, and especially when I went overseas, my concern for my family was indeed quite an experience, but I often thought back at the time how my folks and my family worried about me, mm-hmm. not knowing, you know. And then during the wartime, you know, many times, in fact, I know some of my friends, the parents got an officer called on their home, and they always had a message that they lost their son in battle. This kind of, and I know one family in particular in Portland that, and this was not during the World War II, but it was in the Korean War, that this fellow was, he was a builder, house builder and carpenter, and he was out on a job, and when he saw this military car come in with an officer and walking up to the door, he thought for a moment. He said, oh, this is not good news, because that's generally the way an altar will announce to the family that there's a casualty in the family. And so I remember those things.
Well, now, you said you did menial jobs. Could you describe some of your work there in Kentucky?
What kind of
you did menial jobs when you were
yes
first
well
infected.
I well do you want did you want me to relate some of the things I did?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Well, we had to clean the men's latrine. Mm-hmm. I mean, every day, and that was not very pleasant. But I think to some extent, I don't know whether we were discriminated against, but because of our status, us Japanese American soldiers being on a non-combatant status had to serve the service in some way, so I think that's why they used us to do these jobs. And however, there were other jobs that were a little more pleasant, like shoveling coal on coal trucks, because there was a lot of coal used back there in these induction centers. And we had to be help in the kitchen, cleaning pots and pans, and gardening. Whether the weather was good or bad, it was a job to do.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever wonder how long you'd be doing this kind of work?
Well, I guess I did at the time, but we just, all of us there, the Japanese Americans, we kind of, we're all bunched together, so we kind of took it in stride and made the best of it, and we were young, so we did, however, wonder our destiny, what it would be, but...
I know just the fact of your being in the military sort of probably attested to your patriotism, but did you make any effort when you were in the military to project a more patriotic image or...
Well, for that question, we probably did not. In fact, it was probably expressed a... more of a, anti-feeling. In other words, we felt that we were not treated justly, and so we did want to actually go to training and join a combat unit and to go somewhere to kind of prove our loyalty, but we just figured that was just what it was not meant to be.
Mm. So what did happen after you had been there for a while?
Well, I think I repeated, I said this in my earlier interview, that after a time, the Assistant Secretary of War, John McCloy,
yes,
through research, found that the Japanese Americans were have a position that we wanted to prove ourselves. So through the Japanese American Citizens League, the secretary, assistant secretary, decided that we would not, we would be a good group to serve. So in 1943, and I don't remember the month, but they decided that they would form an all-Japanese American unit as a fighting group, a regiment. So in that effort, why for myself, I was, we took a second basic training, an infantry unit, and in, let's see, 1944, I can't think back the exact time, but I think early part of 1944, then we were committed after our basic training to go overseas and join the 442nd Combat Unit.
Was it preferable to you then? I'm gathering from what you're saying, it was more desirable to be in battle than it was to be at the doing your other jobs.
Well, we were kind of tired, and we felt that because of the conditions in the fighting world, we were not being very useful. And I think there's a certain amount of pride involved in all of us too, that we felt, gee, we want to be more directly involved in the war effort rather than to be placed in a compromised situation.
Mm-hmm. So when you you went to the combat unit, what was that like? You mentioned you went to Italy.
Well, it's something that happened many years ago, and it's hard for me to recall, but I know that when we've boarded a boat in Virginia, port of debarkation, and it took us 21 days to go to Europe, and we landed in Naples, but during that time, normally it would not take less than a week to go over, but because of the German submarines and the dangers of being attacked, our course zigzagged back and forth in the Atlantic, and so we had to take that long to reach there, and that's what I remember. It wasn't a pleasant experience because I did get sick many times. Mm. We had to bathe in salt water because, you know, water was precious. Drinking water was precious, and those things weren't very pleasant, as I remembered.
So you landed in Naples. Did you know where you were going after that?
No, we had no idea where we were going to be going. I was actually a replacement. The 100th Battalion were already fighting, and this was somewhere between Naples and Rome. And so when I came in as a replacement, why, our assembly center was in Naples. I recall a little incident when we landed in Naples that we were high up on the deck and looking out at the port, and here we could see Italian people, little kids and even grown-up people, and this is what kind of struck me as kind of an emotional thing. People that are as old as my dad were scrambling with these kids for coins and mementos that we would throw out from the deck to, you know, tease the kids. And we would be throwing American coins and things like that out. And here these people, these older people, they'd be fighting with these kids, scrambling to get these things. And so it was a kind of a touching experience, mm-hmm. you know, because Naples being in war, and it's a very poor country, and so, you know, their living conditions weren't very good. Mm-hmm. So those are some of the things I remember that kind of struck me emotionally mm-hmm. at the time.
Were you able to surmount the language barrier when you?
Well, yeah, it was a problem, but we did the best we could. We knew how to ask for food and just the very basics. Mm-hmm. We learned that.
What did they think about a Japanese unit coming in?
Well, I'm not sure their reaction. We were all GIs and soldiers with, so I'm not sure exactly what their reaction, the civilians who were speaking of.
Yes.
I don't know. They didn't seem to show any discrimination, as I remember it.
Interesting. So I didn't ask you, but what carrier were you on when you went over there?
That I can't repeat that. I don't know. In fact, that was probably the least thing in my mind.
Uh-huh. Okay. So when you got there, what happened when you got to Italy?
Well, we were okay. We debarked there, and of course, being in the military, we had to march and our pack and our rifles and everything, and we had to march to this assembly area in a forest. One thing I remember was that my buddy lost his watch when we were all kind of marching along in uniform, and these Italian kids and people, you know, they're very curious, but they're also what should I say? Anyway, when we were marching, they would strip our watches off our arms when they were not looking, and things like that. In other words, they were pilfering,
mm-hmm.
and it was not a good experience. And of course, we were all alerted that you had to be very careful of your possessions because these people are destitute. Mm-hmm. They'll take anything for money.
Mm-hmm.
Then we did go to this assembly center, and then of course we had to pitch our tents. We had what we call a shelter half. Just a half of a tent, and you would put your shelter half with another buddy's shelter half to make a complete little pup tent that we would stay under. I remember that what we used to wash our face and hands was our steel helmets, because that was the only thing available. So that's common practice.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, my memory is kind of hazy, but we did go on trucks, and we were trucked to a place in Livorno, or I guess it's called Leghorn, in Italy. And then there we were assigned to different units. I was in a replacement unit for Dog Company of the 100th Battalion. And my assignment was in the 81 Mortars. So, and I guess my official duty was to carry the what's known as the 81 millimeter has three parts. One is a base plate, and one is a barrel, and one is a tripod, because they're all very heavy, and I was assigned to carry the barrel of the 81 mortar.
So it had to be assembled at each point then?
Yes, yeah, but that was no problem. You can all rush up, assemble it in less than a minute. And of course it takes a little while for the I've forgotten the name of the job, but he has to search and traverse with his sights to zero in on the target. So that became a little more of a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But I was not as, of course we have training and all that, but I was not, that was not my assignment.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So you were on the front lines then, I guess?
Oh, yes. When you say, when you speak of front lines, the riflemen were actually on the front lines in person-to-person combat, but 81 mortars is a kind of a unit assigned behind the lines to lob mortars over our frontline men to the enemy type of thing. So I guess to that extent, maybe one reason I'm here today, but our casualties in the rifle companies was very extensive.
Mm-hmm. Now, were you, I know this is, I don't know quite how to ask this question, but the people that you were actually engaged in combat with were the Italian, the Italians, or was it Germans?
There were mostly Germans there. We were in Italy, but our contacts or our people that we were fighting were actually Germans that had invaded into that portion of Italy in defensive positions. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure exactly. There were Italian units side by side with the Germans, but principally our actions were against the German soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
So how long were you in this company?
Well, from there on out until I was discharged, I was, so this was, and I'm trying to think when VGA Day was. It was in the 1944,
wasn't it?
Yes.
In June of 1944.
Okay, so about that time, we were in Italy and around, between our principal, for my part, my principal action was from Livorno towards Genoa and then finally towards Milan. Of course, at that time, in 44, the war ending was inevitable, and I guess the German soldiers were somewhat more relaxed, we'll say. So the man-to-man combat type of situation became less and less.
Mm-hmm.
They were more eager to give up than to contest the fighting, you might say. So we ended up actually at the GEDI airport in Milan, where the VE day took place, and we had one of our duties there was to process prisoners, and so as I recall, that was a major event for us.
So these prisoners were held till the end of the war, then, I...
Yes, yes. That's correct. Uh-huh.
Did you ever get any leave from the battle, or were you able to get away for...
That's a good question.
Let you leave for a week or so?
That's a good question. I have to kind of try to remember, but after the war, we were just marking time, and I think they were trying to decide whether we should regroup and send us to the Pacific Theater of Operations. And during that time, they did give us leaves. And as I remember now, I did go to Switzerland for a short vacation. And I do remember, and these are some things I just kind of remember off the top of my head, that there was an observation point on top of Matterhorn, and the way to get there was by an underground tramway that went underneath to climb the mountains, and I remember riding in that thing. to get to the top. And when we got to the top, it was cloudy, we couldn't see anything. So I guess my recollection are things that were not important at the time.
Well, sometimes you just need to rest. It's not really important about what you do so much as just getting away. So do you think you got more support? I mean, let's just say recognition for your service, for being in the Army after you've been in combat. I mean, do you think there was less discrimination after you were in combat?
You're referring to a time back in the States?
No, I mean when you're actually over there engaged in battle.
Or during the service time, there was no discrimination at all. In fact, we were associated with black Americans. They had their fighting unit also. And we had no... During the service, actually, I didn't experience any discrimination because we were all in it for the common effort, and other GIs, every GI, very cordial to us. Yeah, there was no discrimination.
Were you allowed then to be in contact with your family?
Be in contact?
Yes. Could you write to them and... receive letters from?
Oh, no, there was no such contacts. No, we didn't maintain any, just the visual contacts when we were there, that's all. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, during those GI days, it was a very, what should I say? I was not aware of anything like that. We felt like everyone was just one of us.
Mm-hmm.
The only not discrimination, but we had, our superiors, our commissioned officers, we had to respect them, and I think that was more of a traumatic experience that we had to, because they had their rank and their bars and so forth, we had to respect them. Of course, that's natural in the service.
Mm-hmm. Were they Japanese American too?
Both, yeah. But that was something that we had to always be aware of, versus any concern for discrimination by natives.
Mm-hmm.
Is what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. What did you think would happen in this war? Did you have a foreseeable end? I mean, that you felt, or? Did you just think you were going to be there as long as it took, or as long as you could remain active? Or how did you envision the war finishing up?
Well, I don't know. I don't know whether I can answer that. Of course, always we wanted to get back to the States, but then... I'm not sure if I can answer your question. Of course, we were anxious to have the war end, but then, not knowing winter, how we knew that the war on the Pacific was still quite intensive. We were happy about the VE Day, but of course we were concerned about the VJ Day mm-hmm. at the time. And then we were unsure about our assignment, whether we would be assigned to the Pacific Theater, and then also concerned about our being returned to America, mm-hmm. what our priorities, you know, they had to assign us priorities based on length of service and other factors, mm-hmm. I believe. But anyway, I don't remember. When I was in Europe, we were under a program whereby we would be sent home based on our length of service, and that was always something I looked forward to. I don't remember mm-hmm. my status, but when the word finally came that my category was able to go home, why it was something I looked forward to.
Oh yes. Yeah. Well, I was going to flash forward a bit. Where were you, or when do you remember the circumstances when you heard that the war had ended?
We were in Milan at the time, because it didn't come as a sudden surprise. It was inevitable, mm-hmm. because we had a newspaper, a media, the Stars and Stripes, and of course that kept us pretty much abreast of the world conditions. And so when VJ Day was announced, we were very happy, but it was not something unforeseen.
So it was just something you expected then?
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
So how long before you were discharged? Were you discharged there, or did you have to come back and go through a standard?
No, okay. I had to come back to Fort Lewis, Washington, where I was inducted before I was discharged. But coming back overseas from Europe, we landed on the East Coast, and we had to board a troop train, and seemed like it took forever to get back to the West Coast, because it had to go various stops en route to discharge soldiers, because this was strictly a troop train, and we had to live on it day and night. And I recall it must have been several days, but it was miserable to the extent of having to live that way, but the anticipation of reaching home was something that kept us going.
Were you the only one, I didn't even ask you, were you the only one in your family to be in the service?
No, I had my other brother, Arthur, uh-huh. 3 years my junior. He was also in the same regiment, but he was assigned to I Company.
So did you see each other then, you and Arthur?
Excuse me. Occasionally I did, yeah, but because I was assigned to there's three divisions, the 100th was A, B, C, and D, and then the 2nd Battalion was E, F, G, H, and the 3rd Battalion was I, J, K, and L. So he was in the 3rd Battalion, and I was in the 1st Battalion.
I see. So you could have a sort of a reunion now and then with each other, or did you just run into each other, or were you able to communicate? Or?
Well, we didn't make a big effort to communicate, but we would run into each other occasionally, mm-hmm. and so we would trade notes.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess more we were more involved with our buddies and.
Uh-huh. Had Arthur, was he discharged also around the same time, or?
As I remember, a little bit after I was, but I can't remember.
Mm-hmm. What were your ambitions on the way home? What were the things you wanted to do first and most, and what was in your mind at that time?
Well, when you say ambitions, I guess I didn't have any ambitions. I was more concerned about my parents, and because they were not, they were still at the away from home, and so my concern was more for getting together with them and to eventually return to our farm here in Hillsboro.
Now, they, you said they had been in a relocation center.
During the evacuation time, when the evacuation order came about, my parents and my older brother George decided to relocate to Eastern Oregon, which is out of the strategic area.
Did they do that voluntarily?
They did this voluntarily, mm-hmm. and moved into a government camp. It was called, I can't recall the name of the camp. This is in Eastern Oregon. Mm-hmm. They voluntarily moved there and then went to help the farm crop harvest in that area. And of course this was to help the war effort because farmhands were needed.
Mm-hmm.
So they were never in a relocation center.
All right. They were, now you said, but it was a government camp that they were in. Was it, or?
I'm not sure exactly what it was. It was called a FSA camp, and I don't recall what it ever meant to be, but it was, I guess, a government-subsidized camp for housing for itinerant workers.
I see, okay. How did they get along there, do you think?
I'm sorry.
How did they get along at that place?
Well, I don't know how to answer that or if I can. I mean, their social life was very limited, and the area farmers, principally row crop farmers, looked to these people to help hand harvest or hand weed and work in the fields.
Mm-hmm.
And so the area farmers were very happy to have available a source of this kind of hand help later.
Now, did your sisters go as well?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yes, I have five sisters, and they were, of course, they were young at the time, and those that were old enough to go out in the field did work. They were, principally, it was a sugar beet country, and they were weeding sugar beets. That was a principal crop at the time.
You know, if the girls, were they able to go to school there?
Yes, they did. They had I'm trying to think. I guess they did go to a temporary school there. I'm not sure whether they went to the public schools or whether it was a temporary school set up just for these people that went into this camp. I'm not sure about that. And then during that time, some of my older sisters made application to leave the camp and go to college. So one went to a college in Minnesota, and I can't think of the name of the college anymore. She was a home ec. She's a home ec major. And then my second sister, of the younger sisters, went to Caldwell, University of Idaho in Caldwell, and there she became, she was majored in education. Mm-hmm. And the others were younger, they were just still in grade school, high school.
So the one that went to home ec, which sister was that?
Her name?
Uh-huh.
Oh, Kate, K-A-T-E.
Uh-huh. And the other?
The second one is Taka, T-A-K-A.
Okay. So they were accepted at these colleges?
Yes, yes. Uh-huh.
How did Kate get interested in going away so far to school at that time? It must have been...
I'm not sure why. I think it was through the influence of a friend she had who was also an evacuee.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not sure the details why she ever went to Minnesota. Mm-hmm. Hamlin, that's the Hamlin College. You call Hamlin?
No, I don't
know if it's still in existence. H-A-M-B-L-I-N, I think.
I'll look it up. Interesting. So when you came back, they hadn't returned yet, or were they still at that camp?
Okay. My folks and my younger sisters purposely waited till I returned to Hillsboro before they came back from the camp because they felt that there would be some moral support for them to return if they had someone in the family that was, you know, in the war effort. And so I think to that extent they felt they wouldn't be welcomed unless our presence made it more comfortable for them.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of how they expressed themselves many times, that they didn't want to come back to Hillsboro until Arthur and I came back.
Mm-hmm.
So
I think that was true with other families as well, wasn't it?
Well, yes, mm-hmm. That's true.
Mm-hmm. So what was the first thing you did when you came back? Did you think about the farm or other things?
Well, I don't recall exactly what took place in my mind at that time. Everything was so changed, of course, and Hillsboro changed, and so I'm sorry, but I just don't recall.
How did you think Hillsboro had changed?
Well, because, you know, so many of the GIs were away that everything seemed to be in disarray. In other words, manpower shortage during the war, and so it seemed like that Hillsboro had to really rebuild, you know, roads and everything. Of course, at the time, population of Hillsboro was very small. In fact, I'm going to guess say around 5,000 to 6,000 people at the time. And now, imagine it, today, it has grown tenfold or more because of the influx of high-tech industries. Mm-hmm.
So, how long was it before everybody got reunited here? And
you mean, and my family?
Yes.
I can't recall. I can't recall the time that I was discharged. And I think it's probably in my discharge papers, but I think it was on the November of 1995, as I recall. Mm-hmm.
1945, right.
December.
No, December.
Or November, okay.
Uh-huh. Well, did you come and look at the farm and in the house when you got back?
Yes, I did. And I think maybe I said this or told you in my earlier conversation that my dad finally was able to build a house in 1940, the year of Pearl Harbor, but this was prior to Pearl Harbor. And since I was in the service in January of 42, we never had the opportunity to live in this new house. But when we came back, it was a disappointment. As I probably mentioned before, that the tenants we felt would take care of the house because they were professional people, a doctor, and we felt that someone like that would be sophisticated enough to take care of it, but it was a mistake and they just left it in shambles, and we were very disappointed on our return. And that's how, as I remember recalling, our farm was taken care of by a German neighbor, and when we came back, he was very nice to us and very good, and he took care of our fields and our property.
What was that neighbor's name?
His name was Frudenthal, and I'm not sure if I can spell that. Mm-hmm. But it's a common German name. Ed, his first name is Ed, Ed Frudenthal. But he was very sympathetic for our cause. Mm-hmm. And of course, being of German descent at the time, I suppose that that had some influence.
Mm-hmm. I read that there was a sort of a connection between the German Americans and Japanese Americans during that period, just in general.
Yes, because my understanding at that time that some German nationals and Italian nationals were suspect, and some, I guess, were taken in, but there was no mass confinement for them. Mm-hmm. So, to some extent, it was kind of ironic why the Japanese were singled out, maybe because of identity not concerns but identity advantages, we'll say, because Orientals look different, and so it'd be very, very difficult to round up all Caucasian Germans or Italians, I would say, at the time. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason, I kind of think it was discriminatory towards Orientals at the time.
Mm-hmm. Was when you got back into the community again, were there agencies or groups like the Japanese American Citizens League or anybody like that that helped pave the way for you to get to establish yourselves again?
Well, yes. We have probably some newspaper clippings in that manual that I gave you that might help you explain that. But they were very helpful in trying to reestablish ourselves and reestablish our image, and to help us become more socially acceptable. In fact, many times I think that the war effort, not the war effort, but the war created an atmosphere whereby the Japanese Americans dispersed in the United States, in the continental United States, because prior to the war, we were more in colonies in major cities on the West Coast. We did not go out and live in various parts of the States because we didn't have the opportunity. But when after the war broke out and many of the younger people went off to various places in schools and colleges and thereby gained some familiarity with other places and finally married and established families and sought their livelihood. So in Chicago and Washington D.C. and New York and other cities where they made their homes.
Mm-hmm.
So to that extent, the evacuation made us more to live within the United States more than the West Coast.
Mm-hmm. I read somewhere that the Intermountain States, Utah and Colorado, was a safe place for Japanese to a certain extent.
Well,
the further east you got, the more secure it seemed to be.
The mountain states, there were quite a few families, say, that lived not on the West Coast, that so they did not have to evacuate. They were already established, so that gave reason for a lot of the evacuees to seek out friends and places. And the mountain states were not so far away, but I know a lot of them settled in Chicago and Ohio and New York and Washington, D.C. Just to get away from the West Coast.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said before our interview, you mentioned you thought that this whole event of the relocation, or the discrimination, I should say, was coming to a head anyway before the war. Could you tell me about that again?
Well, I'm not quite sure what you mean, but there was, prior to the war, there was some discrimination, but it wasn't that intensive. There was, at the time, let's see, around in 1920s, when there was quite a movement to prevent Japanese nationals from owning land and property. Mm-hmm. And so I think in 1924 this Exclusion Act came into a law whereby the Japanese nationals could not buy any property, whether it's farm or business or whatever. So, but during my school days in the 30s, I don't recall I suppose covertly there was probably some discrimination, but I don't recall too much about that. Mm. Not as much as, say, right at during Pearl Harbor time. That was, of course, that discrimination at that time, I think, was based a lot on economic reasons. They felt that since we had no time to dispose of our assets, especially on farms, that or farm equipment, homes, and so forth, that I think selfish people had other ideas about taking over and taking advantage of a situation mm-hmm. where we had no control.
Did you know people that happened to, whose land was seized?
Not any specific situations, Linda, but we read at the time of so much in newspapers, and probably those clippings might help you, but of course that's not helping our interview.
Well, I guess I have another question here. What I know, you described your life in early life, or in high school at least, as being rather isolated living here, but was there ever any connection with the Japanese families in Hood River, say, for example, or Gresham? Any opportunities to interact with them? And I mean, I'm thinking of this because of, especially Hood River, because of everything that happened there that was related to the war and the veterans there. But pre-war, were you ever connected with them in any way? And then maybe even post-war, was there ever connection?
Prior to the war?
Yes.
And you're speaking, referring to discrimination?
No, just a social connection or a solidarity, let's say, with
Well, I, at that time, of course, we tend to just be among ourselves more, and the only organization that I guess we leaned to was the Japanese American Citizens League, and that was a organization that championed our cause, and that kind of held us together. But it seems to me that in those early days we did not fraternize too much with the outside Caucasian community. Mm-hmm. And we were kind of by ourselves. And I think that was not probably a proper thing to do, but then language barriers and things like that, customs and cultures were different, so it didn't appeal, we'll say, or we didn't want to. We had no prejudice, but we just didn't feel comfortable to be socializing too much mm-hmm. with the outside communities.
Mm-hmm. When do you think those barriers began to break down?
Well, I think after the war, Linda, that the outside world kind of became more aware of our presence and the fact that we're just look different, but we're not that objectionable people, I guess.
Mm-hmm. What about the great civil rights issues that were carried forth after the war? I mean, the relocation centers, the deprivation of everybody. I mean, that sort of, I'm gathering from what I'm reading, gained credibility as a cause too. That there was a large wrong committed during this period. And my perception is that perhaps maybe might have contributed to your credibility as an ethnic group.
Well, I think it did have some value to the Japanese American Citizen League. was the organization that took the lead to try to rectify the say the wrongs and injustices that were brought to us. I think principally the main issue for our group was the fact that we were forced to evacuate from the West Coast, from the strategic areas, and so our principal leaders sought out people, you know, congressmen and influential people to fight for our cause.
Mm-hmm.
So that was quite a issue in those days after the war.
Did your family have any feeling about righting a wrong?
I'm sorry.
Did your family, did your parents and your brothers and sisters have any feeling about righting this wrong that had been done? I mean, did they support this political, I'm sorry.
Let's see.
I had asked you if your family had supported the political efforts of the Japanese American Citizens
yeah.
League and others.
Yes, they did very much so. In fact, we felt that the injustices that we had suffered we wanted to try to get the government to consider helping us.
What kind of help did you think they might be able to give?
Well, there was two things. One was monetary, but mm-hmm. one was, you might say, the social injustices that came about. Mm-hmm. But in our view, the way the American people say rectify injustices by a monetary means as well. So our leaders sought out legislators to introduce bills in Congress that would give us reparation monies. So I don't recall the year, but after many years of debate, the law finally passed that they would reimburse every Japanese, both nationals and American citizens, $20,000 apiece to help us in the recovery.
And did the government follow through with that?
Yes, that took place, and I can't recall the year that took place, but yes, I did receive my check.
Mm-hmm.
Long gone now.
Uh-huh, but well, I can remember, it hasn't been that long ago, I don't think, since I read about it.
No, it's not that long ago. My memory, however, is short. I'm going to guess, 10, 15,
yes,
well, more than 10 years, maybe 20 years ago, I'm going to guess,
uh-huh.
yeah. But, so to that extent, it was gratifying.
Uh-huh. Did that have any effect in bringing Japanese Americans together as well? I mean, just bringing them all together to make this point with the government?
Well, Well, naturally, our focus was to have the government make amends, and so the community or the Japanese as a whole, like, naturally, they were behind our effort to pursue this thing.
Okay. Well, it's interesting, your observations. I think maybe we should probably finish for today.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
And we'll meet again another time.
It's taxing my memory.